Come gather round, people, wherever you roam.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
I built my own radioactive chamber out of books to try and become Dr. Manhattan.
I love books so much that the resultant psychic shockwave made half of the city feel good about themselves.
Or feel fat.
The resultant psychic shockwave made people fatter.
Damn you! So, I'm Gabs.
I'm Ben.
And this week we read Watchmen.
Watchmen by Alan Moore.
Illustrated by Dave Gibbons.
So, a graphic novel.
Mm. Yes. Mm. Our first graphic novel.
Yes, so for those of you who don't like to read and just like pictures, this is still not going to be good for you because there's a lot of text.
A lot of it, actually.
Way a lot of text.
As a graphic novel, it is legitimately a novel. Just because it has pictures doesn't mean it's not a novel.
Yeah, it's going to take you about as much time to get through as any novel you've read. Especially if you read all the in-between chapter stuff and the...
Which you should.
Which you should, because it's good, yeah.
I think Ben mentioned it's on the Times bestseller list, or Jesus.
Time Magazine's top 100 novels of all
Thank
time.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's the only graphic novel on the list. Wow. Which is maybe a mite unfair, actually.
Yeah, I've read some pretty good ones, but this one, I mean, this one is, I would say, legitimately the best of the ones I've read so far.
It's probably the classic, the graphic novel everyone knows. I was lucky enough to take an English class in college that was actually a graphic novel class. So we did end up reading one book in it, but everything else was a graphic novel, which was awesome because it was English class, but with graphic novels, and I had no experience, and our professor was super into it. He's a total nerd. It was a really awesome class, though, and it taught us a lot about people's, you know, innate biases towards graphic novels, because everyone goes, oh, those are just comic books. You're just reading Spider-Man or whatever right. they think. And how the funnies in newspapers actually then make people think even less of graphic novels, because then they're just thinking, like, one gag.
To be fair, most of the funnies in newspapers should...
Are terrible?
...delegitimize three-panel comics telling one joke. Because most of them are really bad.
Most are bad. Yeah, I would agree with that. Anyway, this is a graphic novel, and I guess our point before we start is don't look down on it. Because it's got illustrations.
Yeah, don't be... that guy. Don't turn your nose up at it because you're too hip.
I only read books with tightly, densely packed text that are at least 600 pages long.
So you only read George R.R. Martin
yes,
books?
I only read Game of Thrones.
The only books that I read.
The sign of a true snob only reads Game of Thrones.
And The Stand by Stephen
King. And The Stand by Stephen King. That's right.
The only books. Well, okay, so one of the reasons we picked this book is because of our Banned Book Week theme. And although it doesn't really appear on the list of most challenged books, and I think part of that is because kids who are in the 8th grade don't get assigned Watchmen.
I bet it's hard to walk into a middle school library and find Watchmen.
I bet it'd be hard to find one in a high school library.
I bet that it tends not to make the collection and no one ever has to ban it or challenge it because whoever buys books for those libraries looks at it and goes, that doesn't belong in a school library. It's a comic book.
Either that or a 16-year-old is not going to read Watchmen.
To be fair, a 16-year-old who... Well, there are 16-year-olds who can read Watchmen, but the 16-year-old who actually grasps everything they're reading in it would be a pretty impressive kid.
Yes. I definitely think it's an adult book.
Yeah, well, the timing of the book, because we were going to get into that at some point, I think, is kind of aimed at, you know, like the you know, I'm going to get my ages mixed up for comic books because I'm not a big comic book guy, but, you know, isn't the golden age of comics supposed to be like the 1950s, 60s kind of, where Superman hits the scene and...
Superman hit the scene in the 30s, actually.
Okay, so...
And so did the Fantastic Four.
So maybe it was post-war when the boom really happened is what I'm thinking of. But, you know, if you were 10 in, say, 1958, and then about 30-ish years later, here comes Watchmen, then you would be about the same age as... the main characters.
That's true.
And you would have been familiar enough with all the superhero lore for enough years to really understand what exactly the subject material of the book is.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons I think you also have to be a little older is as someone who was born in the 80s, the late 80s, I'm sure I didn't get all of the stuff that was going on. I'm smart enough and aware enough, I guess, that I got a lot of the cultural relevance. But if you're a kid and you don't really know much about American history or culture, you might not get a lot of the underlying things going on.
I guess I left that part of it out. Yeah, there's definitely like a good grasp of what exactly the Cold War meant in this country and the underlying fear.
Vietnam.
It's actually, I think it's fairly comparable to, in a lot of ways, the post 9/11 freak out we had. The Cold War was kind of like that kind of tension, like a low level of that tension, not a total freak out, because you can't, that you just can't sustain that for 40-odd years.
And we didn't go into Russia and start.
Right, but it was that kind of level of fear, definitely, among some people for decades at a time. And I think, you know, I was born in 1982, so I barely remember that. I remember watching the Berlin Wall fall on TV, but I don't really remember, I don't have any adult memories of what it felt like to live in that kind of culture.
Obviously, me neither. So before we really get started, I guess first we want to say we do have a spoiler policy. The book is older than me, but if you haven't read it, then you might want to go away, because we are going to talk about the entire book.
You should be aware that our spoiler policy is we will spoil it. And so if you want to duck out because of that, if you're someone that just ruins it for, then leave right now, because we're about to drop our famous spoiler bomb.
Yeah. We actually have two this week.
Okay. Like
the comedian is Lori's dad.
What? And Adrian is the mastermind behind the whole plot.
And a squid kills 4 million people, but oh, yeah, it's
half
not,
of New York.
It's not ridiculous.
Yeah, half of New York dies from an alien squid teleporting on top of them.
I read somewhere that in the movie they changed it to a nuke because they thought the audience would go, "Squid? That's stupid." And then you read the book and it actually really works.
Yeah, it does.
So don't turn your nose up at the squid.
That's right.
The psychic squid that explodes.
Exploding psychic squid.
We did want to try something else this week as well, by request of our friend Kevin, who asked for just a couple minutes of an actual plot synopsis, just in case it's been a while since you've read the book, or you're maybe going to read the book, but not for a while, and you want to listen to the podcast anyway, just to give you a little bit of context. So Ben's going to try to give you a couple minutes, and I'm going to try to cut him off if he goes too long.
I'm going to take a stab at this. I probably should have outlined this to do it really efficiently, but basically, the comedian dies, and there is intrigue afoot. Rorschach thinks there's someone out to get masks, people who used to be costumed vigilantes, because they're really not superheroes for the most part. Except for one guy, Dr. Manhattan, who is in fact a superhero and has nearly godlike powers. And He is, well, basically his girlfriend of two decades, Lori Juspezic.
Yeah, I can't pronounce
it. It's a tough name. She leaves him. He's confronted on TV in an interview with all this stuff that surrounded his past, and then he says, F this, and he goes to Mars because he can teleport. And also doesn't need to breathe, apparently. And let's see. In the meantime, Rorschach gets himself arrested, goes to prison. The Night Owl and the Silk Spectre, Lori, and come out of retirement. They bust Rorschach out of prison. They figure out that Adrian's been behind all the shenanigans. They go to Antarctica to confront him. He reveals that he is planning to teleport a giant telepathic alien squid into New York and kill most of them to ease the Cold War tensions because the world is on the brink of full-scale nuclear war. It convinces the rest of the Watchmen that his path is the righteous path, and he would have gotten away with it anyway because he's so fucking smart. And then Doc Manhattan flies off a billion light years away to become a god. The end.
That's it. That's as easy. That's so simple. That's all that happens. I think we can just turn it off right now.
There we go.
We should mention that you'll notice Ben said costume vigilantes, and then we have an actual guy with powers in Dr. Manhattan. This is a world where, right around the time comic books came out, some kind of nutty people decided at the same time, oh, that looks like something I can do and help protect the world. And so you had people coming out in these costumes to be superheroes who didn't legitimately have superpowers. But that's a reference that this world gets, is people who dress up as superheroes without legitimately being actual superheroes.
Yes.
And then in Dr. Manhattan, you have someone who does have a lot of superhero-type powers.
Yeah, and a lot of the world that was created for this story is based around that.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you had to describe the world this story takes place in as short a time as possible, you could say Superman is real.
Yeah. But he's not from planet Krypton.
Right. You even say Superman is real and he's an American, which is a line from the book.
But because of that, one of the things the book does a lot of is point out various things about superheroes people who read comics would be familiar with. You have a lot of the deconstruction of the superhero, first of all in the fact that most of them don't have superpowers, second of all in the fact that some of them are actually more douchey than they are good heroic people.
Right.
And thirdly in the fact that maybe what they're doing is not actually doing as much good as they think it is.
Yeah, and for that matter, the superhero, the one who actually is a superhero with superpowers, is because of his powers is so detached from humanity that you question whether he's a force for good as well, I think.
Well, one of the main plots surrounding him is whether he should even bother to help save Earth. If human life is even worth it.
Yeah.
So, you could argue he's a little detached.
A little bit.
So, I guess, does it really surprise anyone that this book doesn't really follow around a single person and no one really counts as a protagonist? Which we'll get into in just a second. So, what's our one-sentence plot synopsis?
Who watches the Watchmen?
Who washes the Watchman?
Who waltzes the waltz man?
Who walks the Walkman?
Who wishes the wish man?
Yes. Who?
Who works the workman?
Who works work it? Who wishes the wish man? Who watches the Watchmen is the rallying cry of people who think that the Watchmen are too powerful and actually...
Yeah, well, and in fact,
making things shitty.
costumed vigilantism has been outlawed for several years.
By the Keene Act in 1977.
Yes, the Keene Act in 1977. and so, really, their government has a couple of such folks that they sponsor, Doc Manhattan and the comedian, and then there's Rorschach, who's out operating anyway.
Yes. I think they said when they passed the Keene Act and told them they were outlawed, Rorschach dropped a dead serial rapist in front of the police station with a note attached to him saying, never. Because Rorschach is a crazy son of a bitch.
Yes, he is.
we mentioned the story takes place in the 80s, specifically the year 1985. So this is actually at the latter end of the Cold War in real life, right?
Yep.
When I don't even remember when the Berlin Wall came down.
Berlin Wall, 1989.
Okay, that's what I thought.
I think the coup in the Soviet Union was in 91.
So things are kind of winding down at this point.
Or they would be in our reality. In this reality, they're not. The tensions are wound even tighter
than
usual.
Definitely.
Dick Nixon is still the president. Which means he's got to be on like his fourth term.
Uh-huh. People love Richard Nixon as president. Like that fact makes people happy for some reason.
They do kind of like that. I actually just finished another graphic novel, superhero type of story, and in that alternate reality, Dick Nixon won the election instead of Kennedy, and then Kennedy won a couple terms later after Nixon had been in office.
Interesting.
Yeah, never got shot.
I kind of love Dick Nixon just because he was insane.
I just love that line from America the Book about Tricky Dick Nixon.
Also?
Tricky, because he was an agile political operator. Also, he was a dick.
I just like, if you're the president, it's not illegal. Oh my god, you're crazy. And he apparently had, like, paranoid schizophrenia by the end. But anyway, not even important.
Anywho.
As a graphic novel... Well, graphic novels can actually follow one character around, but this one follows multiple characters and plot lines around with multiple forms of narrative. And so Ben and I were kind of having a hard time pinning down the protagonist, one of the reasons being because there's no one character that's really typical protagonist.
Yeah, there's not any one person who... And part of it is the age of the characters, I think, actually. Because they're all a little older and more established psychologically, emotionally. I mean, they have their issues, but... right. But there's not, like, one person who has a narrative beginning to end who, like, really grows as a person throughout it. If anything, it's more like people who have... kind of lost their way a little, and if anything, they rediscover themselves a little bit. But in the process of doing so, they then run full speed into a brick wall as Adrian has been manipulating the whole thing behind the scenes the whole time.
Well, that's one of the things I was going to say is that you typically think of the protagonist as being the person who's doing things. That's kind of what they're supposed to do. But all the characters who are doing things in this book are not protagonists. Veidt, Dr. Manhattan, Rorschach is a very problematic protagonist because he's so fucked up and detached from humanity.
Yeah.
And then the two most human characters in Night Owl / Dan and Lori, they're interesting and they do things, but they're not the driving force behind everything.
Right.
So it's kind of hard to claim them as protagonists.
They're almost like the everyman insert characters, as much as that can be true for, you know, a wealthy costumed vigilante. And,
fake Batman.
Right, fake Batman and a woman who's been living at the heart of power next to a demigod for 20 years.
Yeah. Everyone does that.
Everyone can relate to those situations, surely.
You can also write really boring essays about owls.
Yeah.
That was the worst chapter insert. I hated it. I was like, Dan, you're so boring. Get over it.
Stop being a bird watcher. It's annoying.
I was like, oh, maybe this article will be interesting and give us images about...
It just shows what he's doing when he's not off fighting crime.
Writing boring bird articles. Well, he's called Night Owl, so...
Yeah.
Batman's too crazy to write articles about bats.
That's true.
One thing I wanted to say about Rorschach, about him being a problematic protagonist, and we can just start talking about him as a character in general, is... like Dr. Manhattan, he's detached from reality, but just in a different way.
Yeah, he definitely has a way of looking at the world. And he thinks... I mean, he does think that small actions, small human actions, can and should perhaps be the more important word, consequences, should have consequences.
Mm-hmm.
He has a very black and white moral system that he's... adheres to strictly.
And some of his morals are pretty good, but then the way he thinks about them are not as good.
Well, he has, like, that, the law thing going on. And then he has, like, that Puritan streak that a lot of American heroic characters have going on. But... those are the end goals for him, and he really doesn't care how he gets there.
Also, they're taken... yeah, I was going to say, they're taken to extremes. So his good values of, you know, people should treat their kids well and blah, blah, blah. He'll look at a single mother and be like, whore. You know, like
right.
Running around, like, insulting women constantly for being sluts and... I think a couple times, or after he meets with Veidt, he's like, he's allowed himself to become corrupt.
Yes.
Possibly a homosexual. Yeah. Must investigate.
Must investigate.
He's one of those chodes.
Like, oh, Rorschach.
But then also, so little girl gets kidnapped, he goes to find her. Good, noble cause. But then he ends up, you know... horribly killing and mutilating people and setting houses on fire while he does it.
Yeah, well.
And watching people die, yeah.
Yes, though at least one of those people had it coming.
You could argue that guy deserved it.
Right. He's like, okay, go into this abandoned house, dog's chewing on bones, goes inside, suddenly realizes, oh, the dogs are chewing on the bones of the little girl. Well, guy gets home. Doesn't hear his dogs. Suddenly, the dismembered corpses of the dogs fly through the window. And the guy gets trapped inside the house while Rorschach burns it down. After getting handcuffed to, like, the furnace or something.
But that's very run-of-the-mill for Rorschach. You know, he walks into a bar wanting to figure out the answer to a question that he has. And to get the answer, he'll just walk up to someone and start breaking their fingers.
Yep. Oh, we had an escapee.
Callie!
From Kitty Prison.
Come here. Yeah, so he'll just walk into a bar and start breaking people's fingers.
Grab their hand holding their glass and just squeeze it until the glass breaks.
That was kind of cool.
That was kind of cool.
But you know the kind of terror he incites when he walks into the bar and the bartender starts going, "Don't kill any of my customers."
Like, please don't cause any damage or hurt anybody.
Because that's how he rolls. Also, apparently he never bathes.
Yeah, he's pretty filthy.
It's mentioned several times how horrible he smells.
He's a pretty disgusting person, and, like, right before we hit the record button, him eating his sugar cubes or whatever, and that ronch, ronch.
Ronch, ronch, ronch.
Like, it just, the onomatopoeia for his eating sound effects are disgusting even. Like, he's just a gross person, it sounds like.
And the other thing, one of the things you'll notice... and we'll be talking about the relationship between dialogue and artwork in the book kind of throughout the podcast, since that's obviously an important part of it, is when Rorschach talks, his dialogue bubbles are not the normal round bubbles that you usually see when people are talking in comics. It's got weird jagged edges.
Squiggly border.
Uh-huh. And that's to indicate his weird monotone voice.
Yes.
And that's just one other thing that separates him from everybody else.
Yeah. And he's probably legitimately crazy, too.
Yes.
He refers to his Rorschach mask as his face. And he refers to Kovacs as being the costume.
Mm-hmm.
So he's, like, part of this, part of his losing touch with reality was that the costume became the person.
Uh-huh.
And when he became Rorschach, that's when...
He got...
That's when his morality became more questionable, perhaps.
Yeah, so you can see why it's kind of difficult to call him a protagonist. He does have a fair amount of narration because he keeps a journal throughout. And so you get Rorschach's diaries. He's going around doing things. And he does try to figure out what's going on with the death of the comedian and figuring all this out, which are protagonist-type actions. But the fact that he's just so removed from what people are.
Right, yeah. And I compared him to if you're into nerd games, role-playing games, tabletop, rolling some dice every now and again. I compared him to the lawful type of character, which a lot of new players or less subtle players do not understand is not actually a limitation. They go, oh, well, if I make my... They always want to play the neutral character,
mm-hmm.
or the chaotic character, which is frequently annoying because they're like, ah, that guy gave me lip. I'm going to punch him in the face and set the house on fire. And it's like, you're annoying. But it doesn't mean you have to follow the rules of the place that you're in. It means you have to follow your rules
mm-hmm.
to a T.
And Rorschach does.
Unbendingly. And he does. Exactly. He breaks a lot of laws enforcing his own rules, which he considers to be just.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it at the end when they're all talking about Veidt's plan and everyone goes, well, it's actually going to work. And Rorschach says, no, I have to go tell everyone. And
yep,
they say,
it's
but don't you see what it's going to do? And he says, it doesn't matter. Never compromise.
Never compromise.
So, there you go.
It's him. That's, yeah, him in a nutshell.
You want to talk about some of the other guys?
Yep, let's hit them.
All right.
So Dan Dreiberg / the Night Owl. The new Night Owl, I guess.
Yes, Night Owl 2, version 2.0.
The sad Batman, as you were calling him.
Well, he wears, you know, a flying...
He's wealthy.
...creature. He's wealthy. He has all the gadgets.
A basement cave thing full of cool gadgets.
I mean, he made Rorschach his grappling gun, which is a total Batman thing, and his little belt of tricks, which is a Batman thing, and his little flying machine, which is a Batman thing.
His little owl cart and a little owl aircraft, and yeah, that's so bad.
I just love throughout the book how people keep finding new things. What's this? Oh, that's my aquatic owl costume.
Yeah.
And they can see Antarctica.
And he has an Arctic owl costume. And he has like a radiation proof owl costume.
Yeah. He's a little out of control. He's like the bored millionaire plane superhero.
He's a bored rich guy who happens to be a pretty brilliant engineer, it sounds like, too.
Because he's making
everything
himself.
Because he's building all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
And, hey, what's that big thing in the corner? Oh, that's a powered exoskeleton I was experimenting with. It doesn't work. I tried it once, broke my arm. Never again.
Oh, okay.
He's like, all right. Crazy, whatever you say.
And the reason I called Dan Sad Batman is because he's a little overweight, wears glasses, and he's just extremely underconfident.
Yeah, he's...
In all of his conversations, he ends up, well, why did you think that about, oh, okay, Dan, sack up, dude.
He's like, oh, well, if you need a place to stay, Lori, you could stay at my place. Oh, thanks, Dan. Great. Now, I guess I'll just go wander over here quietly and be sad. It's like, God damn it.
Dan! Well, I mean, which is part, you can definitely see then the appeal to being Night Owl, because as Night Owl, he can be a man of action, someone who's confident, someone who saves people instead of awkward shambling around Dan.
That's right.
Who's feeling kind of fat.
Though he does still have his moves and his strength, it appears.
Yeah.
Even in the alley when he's not in costume.
Yeah, when
he and Lori kick some punk ass.
Beat the shit out of some knotheads. And it's pretty telling for Dan's character that as when Lori tries to instigate the moves on him, and, you know, she's pretty fucking cool, so he, like, wants a piece of that.
He's been wanting a piece of that for years, for it sounds while. Like, yeah.
And, but he can't do it, can't get it up, because he's, as Dan, he's just so impotent, basically.
Right.
I think he actually says, I feel so impotent.
Yeah, he did, actually.
And then when they get in their costumes and go out and save all the people from the burning tenement, after that, he and Lori are able to have sex, because now he's kind of been able to step into this night owl role, who's a confident guy.
It's one of the features of the night owl costume. Gives you hard erections.
Gives you erections. Well, and then later he's able to bang her without the costume. But he just needed that little bit of help.
That's right. It's the little blue pill for aging superheroes.
He definitely steps into his own a little more, but you can definitely tell that the superhero thing is what really lights him up.
Yeah, I mean, it's what's been missing from his life. It's why he's sad, I think, actually. Because Batman is dark and brooding all the time. Night Owl is only dark and brooding when he doesn't get to be the Night Owl.
Yeah.
Once he puts the costume on, he's like, super, yeah!
He's a super friendly guy.
He'll kick some bad guy ass.
I'm gonna...
rescue people from a burning tenement building. Yeah. Like, and it's like freaking coffee dispenser in his night chip.
Go feel free to have some coffee. I'm just gonna play you this old school song over the loudspeakers. And
gently drop you off in a safe place.
Have fun, everyone.
And fly home. And he's also the straight man for the running gags in this book.
Yes.
There's not a lot of humor in it, but there is the running gag of
The sugar
cubes for Rorschach, or Rorschach breaking the lock on his door, like, every week.
Uh-huh.
Or the lighter, what looks like the lighter button on the console of his owl ship actually being the flamethrower.
That was pretty good. Yep. Yeah, I liked the right before he and Lori have sex and she accidentally bumps it with her elbow and it shoots up. I wonder if that's symbolic of anything.
Yeah, I forgot to put that in our symbols category.
Night Owl just got a boner, guys. When he gets a boner, flames shoot into the air.
That is how manly he is once he gets in costume.
I want to date that guy. He's like, I want you, and flames just shoot up around him. Let's do this. I'm impressed. I don't even know you, but let's have sex.
Let's try this. It might be good.
So the other half of that, I guess we might as well talk about Lori since we've been mentioning her. So she's actually the daughter of the older generation of superheroes.
Yeah, she's another. So we have Night Owl 2 and Silk Spectre 2.
Yes. And she basically got pushed into the profession by her mother.
Which is kind of odd. You'd think that's a profession prowling around after dark, intentionally putting yourself in harm's way, that a mother would not try to push her daughter into.
Yeah, well.
But, you know, then again, her mother was one of the original costumed vigilantes.
She definitely had a taste for fame.
Yes.
She definitely has more than a hint of vanity.
Yes.
So she's kind of reliving her glory days through Lori, I think.
Yep, you gotta train so you can kick some ass, Mom. I'm only 13.
Also, I like how she's 65 and in a nursing home and like, I'm so old. You're 65, woman?
Yeah, come on.
Get out there and do something.
Our mom is 64 and she's out wandering around causing
mayhem. That's true. Our mom is a supervillain. Unintentionally, of course.
Unintentional supervillain.
Lori happens to be one of... I would say she's actually the only woman who you could deem as a main character level.
Yes.
There are several other female characters, but Lori's definitely got the most face time and is definitely on par with the other guys we've been talking about. But... luckily for us, even though she is the only one, and I would like to see more women in the book, she at least has a personality and, like, a real character.
Yeah. You know, like, that weird childhood she had some lasting effects on her.
Uh-huh.
The fact that she's been dating a demigod for 20 years has not been great for her emotional health. She's, you know, she's maybe the representative of humanity more so than any other character in this book.
Uh-huh. Well, her humanity is basically what saves...
This is what gets Doc Manhattan to come back to Earth.
Yep.
Well, temporarily. Anyway. Temporarily. But still, he was talking... Basically, he spent an entire chapter talking like he didn't give a shit about humanity. At the end of it said, but, you know, I know you, and that got me to thinking, essentially.
Yeah, his speech about the miracle of life, basically.
Right.
How all these people had to have sex and create life, which is one of however many sperm, which right. is however many chance of living, going on down the line until finally you were born out of these really fucked up circumstances. Because right. it's right after she learns the comedian is her father. So yeah, I guess that's pretty miraculous, and there are 6 billion of you walking around, so... Okay.
Right. The odds of creating any person aren't all that stacked, but the odds of, like, that specific individual coming into being
mm-hmm.
is quite the miracle.
Yes. and... One of the things I like about her is she's got the bite in her to, you know, confront people, but it's not stereotypical sassy girl.
No, not even a little bit.
Not at all, actually.
And it's not stereotypical angry girl either, which is another kind of version of that.
And she's not... I'm just going to sit back while my various boyfriends do things for me.
She just, like, I would say she feels things very deeply. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what marks her character to me.
And she's just, yeah, she just comes across as a rounded person.
Yeah.
From the get-go. Even though she wears some pretty bad outfits.
She does.
Her weird bib pantsuit. I wasn't really sure about that one. But
1980s conception of what the future would look like.
Yeah. Not, okay. I guess.
That's kind of an exception to the rule in this book, because it actually has aged really well. Like, even most of the stylistic things are not ridiculous, which from the 80s is kind of rare.
Yeah, there's Lori's outfit, and I think you could kind of argue...
The knotheads, maybe a bit.
That Ozymandias' outfit is a little over the top. I mean, it's supposed to be.
Right.
But it is still kind of gold tights and purple tunic. It's a little...
Yeah, well, when you're the smartest man in the world and manipulating the entire Earth... The entire population of Earth behind the scenes. You can be a little flamboyant in private.
And when you're obsessed with the ancient world, that outfit totally makes sense.
True.
So, it works. I'm just saying, it is a little...
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Well, how's about Doc Manhattan?
Okay.
The... Superman is real, except that the quote was paraphrased, because apparently what was originally said is, God is real, and he's an American. Though, he does point out that if there is a God, it's not him.
Dr. Manhattan.
Dr. Manhattan, yeah. He has some pretty godlike powers. He actually can just synthesize, create... matter, presumably by manipulating natural forces, but for all intents and purposes, he can create it.
Yeah, and one of the things going on in this 1985 is everyone's driving electric cars.
Yes.
Because of Dr. Manhattan. Because
he single-handedly produced enough of whatever was needed to build all the batteries.
Yep. And he helped make air flight, I think, affordable and widespread. And he did something else. He's done a couple of things, but the one big thing is the electric car,
right?
Which has been around since the 60s,
right? Because materials science was not a problem. So if you cook up a way to do it, then if you could cook up any way to do it, he could help you do it more efficiently and make sure you had access to the stuff you needed for cheap.
Which is kind of funny because we still don't have the electric car. Well, I guess we have some.
We're getting close. But he is... He's rather detached by the time the story is taking place.
Yeah, we should mention he was originally an actual normal human person. And then, much like superhero mythos goes...
Yeah, so he has a very comic booky origin story.
Uh-huh. He accidentally got locked into a radioactive testing...
He was essentially disintegrated down to the atomic level.
Yes.
Except somehow he retained his consciousness through it.
And was able to reconstruct himself.
Except he...
In creepy stages.
Yes, like a couple of systems.
Appearing as a brain randomly, and then as only a muscled figure screaming in front of a complex.
Yeah.
Everyone thought there was probably ghosts around.
And then finally got it figured out and was able to recreate his body, except he recreated it all muscular and blue.
Yes. I'm not really sure why.
I'm not sure why. So in flashbacks and in his flashback, actually the chapter featuring him, we both agree is pretty awesome.
Yes.
Chronology's all over the place in it because he experiences the past, the present, and the future simultaneously. One of those when you're aware of things on like the quantum mechanical level just kind of happens apparently. And so the chapter is really kind of told from that perspective.
Which is one of the really good parts about it.
Yeah, it's super cool.
That it jumps back and forth through time.
Yeah. And I think actually, I just stumbled upon this idea, but I think one of the signs of his losing his connection to the rest of humanity is when he is first revealed by the government to exist. Like, he's always wearing three-piece suits, and his superhero costume is like this ankle-to-neck jumpsuit sort of thing. And as time passes, the amount of clothing he wears gradually reduces, and by the current day of the story, he is buck naked all the time.
He puts on a suit at one point because he's going to be on television.
Yes.
But then when he goes to Mars, he takes it all off, and I don't think he wears clothes again for the rest of the book.
Right, and for that matter, just hanging out in his lab before he's going on TV, he was not wearing a stitch of clothing.
No.
And actually he had like four of himself wandering around, as it so happens.
That also happened. Which, by the way, if you can make four of yourself, don't have sex with your girlfriend in one form and do work in the other form.
Yeah, she doesn't take that well.
Not very cool.
Feels like she should be getting more attention from you. But at the same time, a couple of those forms were in the room with her, and that was a little too much attention.
That would be creepy.
That would be a problem.
I get where she's coming from. I think it's less, you know, why are there two of you, and more like, oh my god, first of all, you can clone yourself.
Right. Like,
so that's fucked up.
I just learned that was one of your powers, like, literally now.
And we've been dating for 20 years. Living together for 17 or whatever.
Right.
So that's fucked up. And he's doing work while he's pleasing her, because it's all about pleasing her since he's not interested in sex anymore. Which is actually another way he's detaching from humanity. And I think that scene is really just Laurie's realization of, oh god, you're just not human.
Right.
I can't handle it. I need to be with people who are people.
Right. And then in the interview, people are pointing out that people who have been close to him, more proximity close than emotionally close in this case, I'd say.
Except for his old girlfriend.
Except for his old girlfriend. Like, we're all coming down with cancer, and hey, maybe people get hurt when they're around you, and they badger him until he just doesn't really care to be around us humans anymore. And, I mean, you feel for him a little bit, because it feels almost like he's trying to cling to a little bit of his humanity, but he literally does not know how anymore.
That's one of the really interesting things and sympathetic things about him, is when he was a human, he was just a really sweet guy, and he's retained a lot of that sweetness and gentleness, but he can't hold on to who he was as a person anymore. And so, he's going through some shit.
Right, and like, with the flick of a finger, he could vaporize half a city if he wanted to.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, he never would, But, like, I think there's kind of a little bit of creepiness to the character, even, just because he could. And he has no legitimate reason to not want to. By in the middle of the story, certainly.
Also, creep factor, he starts dating Lauren, she's 16.
Yeah.
That's pretty fucked up.
That was, yeah.
And he's, well, he doesn't really have an age anymore, but in his 30s.
It was a little not good, maybe. Also, in one of those flashbacks when she had come into the room when her mother had a couple of the old costume guys visiting, and, oh, this is my daughter, Lori, and she was supposed to be 13.
Yeah.
She was not drawn to look
13. She wasn't. She did not look 13.
No, she didn't.
She looked a little younger, but,
she was like a slimmer version of the way she was drawn in the rest of the book, except she had all the same curves and proportions. It's like, she just, if that's how she looks when she's 13, then I don't know. When she was 16, he probably thought she was 26.
Also, word of advice, if you start dating a dude when you're 16 and date him until you're 36, you're probably going to have some messed up ideas about relationships. Especially if he's like a weird god superhero guy.
Actually, given everything that happened in her life, she was surprisingly well adjusted, right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Okay, well, I guess we still need to talk about good old Adrian Veidt.
Yes, Adrian, and also the comedian.
Oh.
Who we haven't really touched on yet.
Yeah.
Let's start with the comedian, actually.
Okay.
Lori's dad. Dear old dad.
No.
Nope. Rapist slash suppressor of the third, oppressor of the third world.
Slash all around shit person.
He is the ultimate cynic, is what he is. I don't know if I think the comedian name maybe wasn't quite as cynical in the beginning of his career when he just wanted to put on a costume and kick thugs' asses down on the docks. But over the years, he grew more and more cynical. He was one of the government-sponsored folks, because if they said, hey, go shoot this guy, he would.
Yeah.
And so to him, the whole world's a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And not in the way where he sits back and is all ironic and postmodern and hilarious, but in the way where he says, the joke is that all of you people think that anything you do matters in this rotten fucking world.
And it doesn't.
And it doesn't. He's like, that's what's hilarious about this. Now, I'll see you later. I have to go shoot people.
I have to go shoot a woman I impregnated.
I have to go knock up. Yeah, I have to go knock up a Vietnamese woman and then shoot her in the stomach.
In her like 9 months pregnant stomach.
Yeah.
Peace.
Peace out.
Which he does.
Yep, that happened.
I would say one of the insane things about the comedian to me is that he does that. He tries to rape Lori's mother, Sally, in a very violent and horrible way, actually, because he's not only a giant creep about it, but beats the shit out of her, and then is stopped by another, by Hooded Justice.
HJ.
Another superhero who kicks his ass and says, get the fuck out of here. Oh, and by the way, the thing Hooded Justice said to Sally after the comedian left pissed me off so bad. He was like, clean yourself up and for God's sakes, put on some real clothes.
Yep.
And I was like, wow, way to be sympathetic,
yep.
Douche. But whatever. Anyway, I just lost my train of thought. Oh, so a character who does those two things, you would think generally you would just all around hate him forever. But like every other character in the novel, it's not that easy, and he does have some moments where, I wouldn't say he's redeemed by any means, but he does have some moments where you see through that shitty, cynical shell and see some humanity in him.
Yeah, well, I mean, you kind of wonder a little bit, because he tries to talk to Lori a couple of times when she was younger, especially, and you kind of, you wonder a little bit what's going on, because you know about the rape, and you're like, is he, dude, it's like, is this some weird grudge? Is he hitting on the daughter now? And no, it turns out that he's trying to get just a tiny bit of fatherly connection, perhaps. Uh-huh. Or when he finds out about Adrian's master plan, because he's the one who cracks it first, and then gets killed for it. But he's, like, drunk and in tears and pouring his heart out because he's so conflicted about it. This the guy who thinks that nothing matters and gives no fucks about anything.
And then he sees Adrian's plan and can't deal.
Yeah, it's like it's too large of a scale for him. Oh, this will kill several million people, but it will save millions more. And he goes, I can't handle that math.
Yeah.
It's too much. I actually referred to this book a couple weeks ago when I was reading it in a tweet as Moral Ambiguity, the Novel.
Yes. It should be pointed out, the only character in the book who's black and white is Rorschach, and he is literally black and white with his face, by
That's
the way.
That's true, yeah.
Oh, symbolism. Ah. And ends up getting killed for it.
Yes.
Exploded for it. So that should tell you something.
Very cleanly.
Should tell you something about characters who don't compromise.
Yeah.
They don't. They don't end up very well.
Also, kind of the weirdness of the comedian raping Sally, but then that wasn't when she got pregnant with Lori.
Yeah.
They actually
did it like, later.
Forgive, forget, had some kind of relationship later, which was not explored in thorough detail, but it was presented as basically Sally said it's too complicated to explain if you weren't, like, one of the people involved.
Yeah, she was pretty interesting when she was talking about it, because she said, you know, I should be enraged about it, but she was just too tired to stay angry.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, like, trying to explain it and can't. She said, I was just so tired. And because, you know, Lori's furious that she's the result of this guy that she's grown up despising.
Hating ever since the book.
Uh-huh. And then there's this weird element of after Lori and her mom talk about it and Lori leaves, her mom actually picks up the old picture of all of the Minutemen and kisses the comedian's picture. So, it's messed up.
It's every kind of complicated,
yes,
is what it is.
And I think they go into it just the right amount, because it's left on this level of, that's the result of these two really interesting characters with a super complicated relationship doing something that doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think if they'd gone too much more into it, people would have started doing the Alan Moore's making a commentary on rape victims and their relationships with the people who, but it never makes that
never,
sort of
never gets all the
commentary.
Way to that level.
No, definitely not. I would say that issue is very specific to those characters, and the book never suggests that's a thing with other people.
Yeah, it's too difficult to explore. Only Adrian Veidt, the smartest man in the world, would have a hope of understanding.
Could unravel that Gordian knot. Bam, bam, bam!
Boom! See that segue.
So, Adrian Veidt.
Ozymandias.
Ozymandias, we should point out, is the Greek name for Ramesses II, who was the pharaoh that everyone knows because he was the Moses pharaoh.
Yes.
Also, he lived to be, like, 94.
Yeah, he hung around for
a while.
So
he was
longer than average. Quite a bit. Quite a bit so.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, he lived a long time for people in the modern day.
Yes.
But Adrian Veidt's whole deal is he's super smart, and he's kind of based his life goal around Alexander the Great, you know, basically conquered the known world and started putting it into unity when he died. Maybe I could actually be the guy who fulfills his original goal.
Maybe I can unite the whole world.
Yeah, that gives him a purpose. Because I think he would be in danger of becoming a rich bored guy too.
Yeah.
But he's so motivated, he decides he's going to set out and save the world, basically.
Here's an alien squid thing to be terrified of as a planet.
Yes. Which, his logic works, I actually would say, very well. I understand what he's doing, and I don't even get that mad at him, which makes me a little worried about my own reasoning. But his love of the classics, I just wanted to talk about that a little bit, because he goes on a spiel about Alexander the Great being a great thinker. If everyone's ever heard of the myth of the Gordian knot, it was this big old knot that had been around for hundreds of years, and people kept trying to untie it. And if you untied it, you got a prize or something. And so the rumor goes that Alexander the Great showed up and said, I want to take a look at this Gordian knot.
I'll unravel this knot.
Yeah, and a bunch of people came around to watch him do it, and then he just pulled out his sword and chopped it in half. And said, okay, unraveled now.
Lateral thinking.
Troll. But that is actually part of his biography. Well, as far as we know.
Right, part of his...
A lot of him
is... His mythos, perhaps.
His mythos, yes. And Veidt loves that, by the way. Lateral thinking. But he's talking about following his path and blah, 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 blah. And I just wanted to point out, because I'm a history major, and I took a class on Alexander the Great, that he was obviously a very impressive historical figure. He was obviously a military genius. I mean, if you die at 33 and you've conquered half the known world, you're obviously...
If you conquer everything between Macedonia and India...
Yeah, you're pretty impressive.
Back when that's where, like, 9 of the 10 most powerful nations on Earth were situated.
Uh-huh. And he did a lot of... One of the things we talked about in my class, you know, he did a lot of really impressive things. When he came in and took over a city, instead of installing some kind of tyranny, like putting a Greek person in charge.
Like an occupational government.
Yeah, he would actually work with the people, he would talk to the people in charge of the town or the city, and then actually keep them in charge, but just loyal to him. And so he created all these satrapies that were loyal to him, basically being able to keep their own culture, but just technically under his rule. And then one of the other things he did is, as he moved along and discovered new culture, he started adopting it himself. So he was kind of trying to create mixed culture. So he started adopting a lot of Eastern practices, which actually pissed off a lot of the Greek and the Macedonians, because they thought it was beneath them.
Right. Multiculturalism.
Yeah, boo. Well, I mean, one of the things he adopted is, in the East, they revered their leaders more as godlike,
right?
And so you would prostrate yourself to your leaders, whereas in with his like Greek and Macedonian soldiers, you just like shake hands with them,
right?
And so then he started demanding proskynesis from everyone underneath him, which is basically the bowing, the lying on the ground, right, kissing the floor crap. And they started going, dude, no.
Well, that would irritate me too.
Yeah. You're thinking too much of yourself. He ended up claiming he was a god, and he basically started taking a megalomaniac turn.
And we all know that once your hubris hits a certain level,
yes,
there has to be an adjustment.
And then I did just want to point out that our professor talked about how in the East, he's actually not known as Alexander the Great. I don't remember if they call him, like, the Terrible or something like that. But the way he conquered India was by going through all the various villages in the jungle and slaughtering everybody.
Well, that's a lot different than how he conquered the rest of the world.
Yes. They don't know exactly how many people he and his men killed, but it's estimated maybe 30 to 50,000 people in India. Just slaughtering them for no reason.
I'm sure there's been a lot of speculation on whether that was pathological.
Yes. So a lot of people in the East don't like him very much.
Fair enough.
And while he was, you know, quote unquote conquering them, because he was slaughtering everybody, he would beat them into submission and take over like he had more in the West. And then the second he left, they would just say, fuck you, and go back to their own stuff. So it's even debatable whether or not he really managed to conquer any of that land.
Right.
and it was horrible and rainy, and then his men mutinied, so they had to turn back.
Ozymandias / Adrian Veidt didn't do any of those things.
No. I just wanted to bring all that up because he idolizes Alexander the Great too much and simplifies him as this man who was a peaceful uniter.
Right.
But he really wasn't. And I guess on the same hand, you could say, well, Adrian Veidt does kill 4 million people for the greater good, which I guess Alexander the Great could also
reason he was doing. You know, if you trade 4 million lives for 6 billion.
Does it seem like an even trade? So, but he's smart as fuck.
Yeah, he does a lot of smart, he does a lot of super smart people things. That's always one, that's one of my favorite character types in stories. Like the genius character who just casually does genius things all the time. And, you know, I'm going to go watch like 40 different news channels at the same time and absorb all of it. And then pick out trends that no one else is noticing because I'm awesome.
I loved how he said he got rid of all of his parents' fortune to prove that he pulled himself up by his bootstraps and 10 years later is a millionaire of a multinational business.
Yep. Oh, Adrian. And he's so smart that he's trained his body to be like the most amazing human body on Earth, even though he's in his 40s.
Yeah,
he catches a freaking bullet.
He literally catches a bullet. Literally.
And in fairness, he was slightly surprised by it, too. He's like, I can actually do it. Like, cool.
I hoped I could, but I actually can.
Like, I thought this was possible, but nice.
And he kicks the asses of the other vigilantes there, and they're all obviously physically superior to the people around them, so...
Yeah, and he just does it casually, too. Like, it's not... He doesn't even break a sweat. And then he's explaining his complicated plan. Oh, that was a great moment. He's classic villain monologuing.
Uh-huh.
And, well, thank goodness we got here in time to stop you. He's like, bitch, please.
He said, you think I would have let you in here if you had any chance of stopping me?
As soon as I saw you on the monitors, I hit the start button.
Yeah, this plan went into action 30 minutes ago.
Oh, crap.
By the way, there's now a squid in New York.
I guess we're not stopping you.
And that is one kind of the... It's one of the such of the great things about Watchmen is this ultimate act of villainy is actually also the ultimate superheroic act.
The motivation behind it is good.
Yep.
And, you know, it goes back to one of my favorite things from literature is, you know, no bad guy is ever bad just for the sake of being bad. And good villains have to have real motivations. And his motivation is real, and it's so good that you could argue he's not even a villain.
That's what I was going to say.
Like, it's really easy to side with him.
Is he really the bad guy? He does save the world from nuclear destruction.
And everybody who isn't Rorschach falls into line with his thinking, even if they don't feel good about it.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Not that they really had any choice.
No. Well, once Dr. Manhattan was on board, yeah, no one had a choice.
Like, oh, okay, I guess that's how that's going to work.
So let's just... talk about a couple more things going down here.
All right.
I just wanted to bring up a theme that we talked about in my class when we read this book that my teacher pointed out I thought was really cool. Is that one of the ways you can tell characters are humanized in this book is if they have sex. Sex is the humanizing force. So... I mentioned one of the reasons Dr. Manhattan is so detached is he's not really interested in sex.
Or Rorschach, who's detached. No sex.
Yeah.
Comedian, kind of detached, mostly has fucked up sex.
Uh-huh. And then one of the really interesting examples is Rorschach's psychologist, who's trying to really, really get a handle on him. And the deeper he goes into Rorschach's mind... the more detached he becomes. And you'll notice that at the beginning of that chapter, his wife manages to pull him away from his work, and they have sex. And then a little later in the chapter, she can't pull him away from his work, and she says something about having needs, which she's referring to sex.
Yes.
And he says, I can't right now, I'm working. And that basically leads to the dissolution of their marriage, is he goes so deep into Rorschach's mind that he's not interested in this human act of sex anymore.
Yeah, Rorschach mentally worked him over.
I mean, to be fair, Rorschach is a black hole.
Yeah. Well, there was the sex there, and then also as that went along, he started calling him Rorschach instead of Walter.
Walter, yep.
Yep.
And then Dan and Lori, who we said are the more everyman characters to a degree.
Kind of.
they're the characters that do have sex. And after Vite puts his plan into action, the two of them, you know, Lori's really upset and Dan's upset. And in order to basically solidify being alive and being human, they have sex. And that's a good thing. Like, Dr. Manhattan's actually... Like, that's the only time he ever smiles is when he sees them
right.
sleeping together afterwards.
When he sees his girlfriend sleeping with a dude, another dude.
Yeah, he's happy about it.
He's cool with it. He knows that that's not for him anyway.
Uh-huh. And then... at the end, and I can't remember their names, so I'm going to call them the lesbians.
Oh, yes.
And I feel really bad about that. Sorry. When those two women are fighting, and the one woman... is accusing, you know, like, you need to get off your drug problem. And the other one says, well, you don't know how to, like, connect to me in a relationship. And then the other woman says, I just want to go to bed with you.
Right.
Like, can we just be close that way? And so that's a plea for human connection.
Right.
And I think that the fact that Vite appears to have no really close friends...
He hangs out with a giant genetically engineered cat thing in Antarctica... and three Vietnamese manservants.
Who he ends up killing.
Well, yes.
For the greater good.
In classical supervillain's plan coming to fruition style.
Yes. But Vite is also...
sexless.
Yes. Or possibly gay, according to Rorschach. But I don't think
he
so.
He does wear the gold and purple tights.
Yeah. I think he's probably just not interested in sex.
He's asexual.
He has bigger things going on.
All right, so more points of interest. We kind of touched on this a little at the very end of our last podcast, but how the artwork and the pictures interact with the words in the storytelling. And I can't speak for exactly how scripts get made for every comic book, but I actually read another graphic novel. It's some extra features in it at the end, and it was the writer and the artist talking about some of their interactions, and I was interested to discover that a lot of the visuals are, or actually pretty much all of the visuals are in the script, and that the writer really lays out what he wants as part of the storytelling, which makes sense in hindsight, and then that the artist kind of realizes it, and a lot of times adds their own touch to it and makes it better.
Yes, because obviously if you have a bad illustrator, even if the artist knows exactly what they want you to see, it's not going to come across.
But the beginning of the last chapter, where New York's been trashed by the giant alien telepathic squid, and it's just like four full pages of just carnage.
It's a really powerful visual.
It really is, and it seems pretty clear to me that that was probably Alan Moore telling Dave Gibbons to just go nuts. He's like, draw me four pages of devastation and make sure that all of the familiar street scenes we've seen so far are contained within it to drive the point home. And he did.
Yeah. and there are a lot of moments, and of course I can't think of any real good specifics off the top of my head, but if you're reading the book and you're really looking out for how pictures and dialogue interact, there are so many moments where the end of a scene, the dialogue at the end of the scene will relate to the first illustration in the new scene, or when background noise will relate directly to what's going on, or one of the features that we didn't really talk about was you have a character who's reading a comic, so you have a comic within a comic, throughout, and a lot of the commentary in his own comic is interacting and relating to what people are saying and the issues going on around him. And it's just actually, like, once you start thinking about it, it's really impressive how closely the two things interconnect.
And some of the visuals, like the couple embracing that the graffiti artists keep throwing up on walls, and then at the... as the squid hits New York, the two Bernards kind of embrace there at the end.
That's one of my favorite visual moments, actually.
Right, that was one you pointed out. When Rorschach pulls the bottom of his mask up to chew on something, just like his stubbled chin, like makes him, I don't know, like the way it's drawn makes him look even grosser and wilder.
There's a theme throughout the book. At the beginning of each different issue, you have blood dripping down toward a clock, which is approaching midnight, and you're thinking like a death day clock and blood. But then in the last chapter, when the blood is finally dripped down a little bit onto the clock, and then you flip the page and it's showing the New York devastation scene, and the first illustration is actual person's blood dripping all over an actual clock.
Right.
And so there's that interaction. That's really cool. Or
the decanter, or actually I think it was a perfume bottle of whatever.
The nostalgia?
Adrian Veidt's, Veidt Industries nostalgia. Turning over and over every time the chronology switches.
Oh, you could also, by the way, if you want to play a game, you can look for Veidt Industries blimps and diners and posters tucked in all over the place. There's one scene that I was thinking of when Dan and Lori are trying to have sex for the first time, and Veidt's gymnastics are going on in the background.
Right.
And the narrator's description of everything that's going on, like, look how amazing this physical performance is, at the same time that Dan can't get it
right
up.
Keep in mind, this is a 45-year-old man.
Yeah, and so you have this, like, total opposites going on. It's really awesome, actually. There's tons of it. So, look out for that, definitely.
All right, strengths and weaknesses of the writing itself.
Really strong writing.
It's really tightly plotted. I actually wonder if the genre, if the medium, I should say, contributes to that. Because I feel like you probably have a very specific amount of space you can use in a serial comic installment. Mm-hmm. As opposed to a novel where if you run over by 100 pages even, your editor might just let you keep all of it.
That's true. Well, look at Stephen King.
Yeah, for example. Well, and if you sell as many copies as he does, I bet if you could sell as many copies of a graphic novel as he does of a regular novel, that he could probably get away with padding that too. But
all right, I'm looking at the book to confirm our theory, and every single issue is 28 pages.
There you go.
So
I
definitely locked in there.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was mentioning to Ben is, looking through it, I was actually a little surprised by how quickly a couple of the plot points happened. And this is on a reread and looking for things.
Right.
I said, oh, I didn't realize that happened so quickly after X. I didn't realize that happened so quickly after X. But when you're actually reading it and the plot's moving along, it doesn't feel too fast or quick.
Right.
It's just that when you think about it afterward, I think you think of it on a slower pace, because maybe we're used to reading books or the way we think of stories. I'm not sure exactly how that works, but I've actually noticed that when I read webcomics too, I'll remember a plot from a webcomic I really like, and then if you go back and read that plot, it'll be half as many pages as you thought
it comes
was.
At you faster than you think.
Uh-huh.
And maybe the visual element helps with that too, because you can get a lot across in a single panel if it's really well done, which in this book, it's really well done.
You don't have to describe every last little detail.
Exactly.
So. Okay. Well, relevance.
Well, superheroes are super hot right now.
It's true.
Hollywood's making money hand over fist on them. Even if they didn't do a great job with the Watchmen movie.
Oh, I do not like this movie.
And people tend to love, or at least when they're well done, people seem to be into the whole deconstruction thing.
And I can't verify this, but I'm pretty sure Watchmen was the first, or at least one of the first, comics to take a stab at the deconstruction of the superhero. And I think a lot of it that came afterward is all stemming from Watchmen.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree. I mean, I read Kick-Ass a few weeks ago, and it really felt to me like a lighter version of Watchmen. Like, you could feel its influence all over it.
Uh-huh. And I'd say that's probably true of a lot of things. It's just one of those big influential books that
yep.
you can't get away from if you want to do that genre, so. All right, questions?
Does the Vite method really work? I'm going to get all super buff.
He's going to go try to be Vite.
I'm learning how to catch bullets.
Skinny, muscly.
Never worry about getting mugged again.
My question is, who watches the Watchmen?
Who watches the Watchmen? Who walks the Walkman?
Who washes the Watchmen? All right, we won't do that again.
Who witches the Witchman?
No, Ben. What's your verdict?
I loved it. Amazing.
Yeah, I think you would have to be, if you hadn't figured out we like it. I don't know. It's good. It's great. It's a great example of a graphic novel. Please don't shy away from it just because you don't want to read a comic book or you're just a dumb. All right.
All right. What you reading right now?
I just picked up for the second time A Feast for Crows by our beloved Gurm. I started reading it. I read the first three in quick succession, picked up the fourth one, got about 100 pages in and went, overload.
You got Gurm fatigue.
Yeah, I put it down for, I'd say I read those last fall, so I put it down for about a year, and then this week I went, you know what, I need to finish this goddamn series. So I picked up A Feast for Crows, and I am reading it.
All right, well, I just picked up The Cider House Rules by John Irving, which I mentioned a few podcasts ago, but I kind of set it down for 3 weeks after I read the first two chapters, and now I'm actually going to finish it, because I actually was enjoying it. I just got distracted by the Dresden Files. Just finished one of those, by the way, Turncoat. Also just finished Red Sun, which was another graphic novel. It was really interesting. It was a reimagining of the Superman story if he had landed in Soviet Russia instead of in the heartland of America.
Which sounds pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, it was really interesting, with a big twist at the end. Woo!
So, that's our podcast. If you would like to drop us a comment, you can do so at www.novelideaspodcast.com.
Or you can send us an email, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
You can tweet us at @novelideaspod.
And if you're an iTunes listener, or if you're not and you want to be one, we're there. And you're doing that, then leave us ratings, reviews, comments, however that all works.
Et cetera, et cetera. And next week.
What is next week?
Come on.
I have no idea.
Can't you read?
The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier.
Neither one of us have actually read this book.
Yeah, I read a book by Robert Cormier, but it wasn't this one, which is weird, because this is the one that I feel
everyone's
like
read.
A lot of people have read. I think it even gets assigned in some classes.
Uh-huh. It's our last book in the Banned Book Week series.
It is the last official book.
Well, there,
we have a couple others coming up.
We will, of course, be reading more banned books all the time. But it's our consciously chosen banned book.
I have to throw this nugget in, too. The last few years, one of the most commonly banned books, and Tango Makes Three, the children's book about gay penguins.
Really, guys?
Come on, America, when will we learn?
That's pathetic.
Even if you're threatened to... How threatened...
Two gay penguins!
...by gayness do you have to be to get upset over a pair of gay penguins? Are they even gay penguins? They're just two male penguins.
Who raise an egg together.
Who raise an egg together.
They're not really even gay.
They're gay-ish.
Yeah. But it's a book that helps teach kids about two dads.
Right.
There's also a book called, I think, Sarah or Jane or whatever, has two moms. And that's banned a lot.
How dare they?
Because, oh my god, it's not the traditional family. We should just read the gayest book we can think of. And then be, bam!
We totally should.
Give us recommendations on good books starring gay characters.
There we go. We'll have a queer month or something.
April is LGBT month.
Oh, that's... All right, we'll talk. We'll talk.
All right. All right. So next week, The Chocolate War, which as far as I know is not gay.
Yeah, to the best of my knowledge. So I guess that's it?
Yep.
Holy cow, that's it. All right, well, then, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye. Like a stone, for the times they are a change.